It's the Real Estate Podcast, brought to you by ANZ Home Loans for financial well-beings.
And welcome back to another episode of the Real Estate Breakfast as we cover the latest property news right across your weekend. If you're relaxing, lucky you. Of course, you'll hear us on iHeartRadio, Spotify, as well as Apple Podcasts and Amazon, just to name a few. Yes, a Sunday morning, Sunday, March the 10th, into double digits already. Hope the weekend is going great guns for you at your place. Coming up in just a moment, we're going to reflect back over what has been another incredibly busy week. Kicked it off on Monday with economist Joey Maloney from the Grattan Institute talking about the disparity between wage growth and house price growth and how to sort of keep updated on all of that. Clinton Waters from Melbourne was in. We were talking about the surge in household home buyer incomes. Pretty interesting if you didn't catch that with Clinton. Also from Perth, we caught up with our regular Matthew Hughes talking about the housing stock levels and the building industry update. And Veronica Morgan was in this week once again talking about buyer's agents and to be very careful when signing a property contract. Do your due diligence thoroughly. And, you know, not a bad idea to include your lawyer in all of this as well, because some people don't. So that is all coming up with our 7 days of reflection next.
We are more than just a real estate podcast. We cover a multitude of subjects, including property data, current buyer-seller sentiment, and the mood of the market. Follow each week all of the main talking points and know your property.
That's right. So the gap between wages and house prices has been growing for some time, multiple decades, really. And so on one side of the equation, you've got wage growth, which, you know, there's been a little burst of it recently, but mostly, at least for the last decade, it was pretty sluggish. But really, most of the action explaining the discrepancy between house prices and wages is due to what's happened to house prices. The last few decades have seen them shoot through the roof to the point where house prices used to be about 4 to 5 times average incomes. Now they're upwards of 10 and even more so in the more desirable parts of Sydney and Melbourne. Now what's happened there is it's really fundamentally demand and supply equation. So there's been lots of factors on the demand side. You know, population growth really picked up, particularly in the late 2000s. Our migrant intake lifted then. More people means you need more homes. There's no way around that. We've also had some tax settings that have encouraged a lot of speculation on housing. So people sometimes point at capital gains tax and negative gearing, although I would argue that the impact of those is generally overstated in the discourse. Another big factor explaining the big run-up in house prices was prolonged low interest rates. Low interest rates affect how much people can and are willing to borrow. And that means that affects how much they're willing to take to the auction with them. The net effect of that is it's bidding house prices up across the country. So that's all on the demand side. But all of that would have mattered a lot less if our supply side was more responsive.
Yeah. And you have advocated for relaxed zoning laws and diversified housing options. So talk all of that through to our audience this morning.
Yeah, that's right. And thanks for asking. I was hoping that we'd go there because, you know, everyone always, there's an inordinate amount of time spent talking about all of those demand side factors, and they all matter in their own right. But fundamentally, our point is that they would have mattered a lot less if we had our supply side of our housing market set up to be more responsive. We would have got a better outcome. Prices would have been lower than they otherwise would have been. And really what we're getting at here is all the restrictions that get in the way of building more homes in the areas where people want to live and work. So, you know, at a high level, that's the zones, which restrict how many levels you can go up in a particular area. But then that's compounded by different neighbourhood character overlays or heritage overlays. And then even at the last hurdle, these things tend to get clutched up in the development approval processes. So the net effect of all of that is to slow housing supply, and to particularly slow housing supply in the really desirable suburbs where people want to live. And we can identify those suburbs because that's where the prices have gone up the most. So our attention has been focused on that issue, on getting the supply side of the market right. There are things we can do on the demand side, but those demand side issues will matter a whole lot less if we can get the supply side working as it should.
Navigate the world of real estate like a pro with expert insights, opinions and trends to up your game and knowledge when buying your next property.
About those applicants who earn more than $200,000, how does this affect those earning less than $150,000? Because people are looking at pretty creative ways of coming up with deposits, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the deposit is the biggest barrier to entry in many regards. And we're seeing there can still be affordability of being able to buy the property that may be targeted by a first home buyer or a low deposit buyer. Having the actual, you know, punching power of putting in the, you know, the 10%, which is really the absolute bare bones minimum cash that you need, is can be quite tricky. That's further being put out of reach by other obvious cost of living expense increases and compounded by that debt sensitization that the banks are applying. Banks are in the business of lending money, and they are getting a little creative themselves in changing some of the policies around that affordability, because we're in a position now where if you've got a buyer that has just scraped together that deposit, you know, being stress tested at 9% is pretty hard.
Yeah, and we've talked on this program about house sharing, like going in with somebody else, might be a sister, a brother, a friend, and you're sharing the cost of that mortgage. Is that something that in the last 12 months you've seen, you've heard of happening where you are?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, there's 7 brokers within our practice. So, you know, we see a lot of different scenarios and we discuss them amongst the team. And we are seeing an increase in the number of people that are buying together. But, you know, a word of caution in doing that is that it really requires quite a medium to long-term strategy in doing that, because it might all seem rosy now to be able to buy the property together. And the way I would sort of pitch it generally to most of our clients is it's not an option of last resort, but getting into bed together to be able to acquire a property is great now, but can create a lot of unforeseen complexities later on down the track, particularly as your financial positions change, your partnership positions change, your you know, what you want, you know, you might need access for equity in that property for other purposes, be it for an emergency or redeploying it into another property. But the other partner or friend that's involved might not want to do that. Pretty easy to getting it set up, but you really need some guardrails and put in place in writing what that exit strategy looks like and putting a time frame on it almost.
Yeah, yeah. If there's ever a time when you've got to do due diligence and you've got to look at worst case scenario, boy, this is an area I wonder 2, 3, 4, 5 years down the path for those people that have gone into this with the very best of intentions, because let's put that out there. That's what it's all about. Home ownership. Let's get into a home. Yes, we can share it with somebody else. But if that due diligence is waning, it's going to sort of come back, isn't it, in a few years' time and really bite hard.
Absolutely. And I mean, the ability of being able to rush in and acquire and do it, it's quite available and it is easier to achieve it. You know, without pointing fingers, these are products. These are products that are pressed by the banks to lend money. And, you know, the suitability test of that requires a much more nuanced discussion around those variables that we just ran about of, is this the only way? Is this the best way of doing it? What's your exit strategy going to look like? Have you considered it? What type of agreement needs to be put in place outside of the lending agreement that's arranged by the bank? And this is where, you know, great mortgage brokers are able to, you know, have this discussion, flesh it out, and really put the options on the table rather than just pressing an individual product pitched by a bank.
Yeah, I can't see anything else happening. Our rate of growth tripled that of the nation in February, and our median prices moved up to a new record again of $687,000 or thereabouts. And the median house price is still only down at 765. So despite the record growth, we're still the second most affordable state capital nationally, and we're well below the national median house price, which speaks to the value that still exists in our market if you're a home buyer or an investor. And we have seen a recent uptick in some vacant land sales and dwelling approvals, but it's still just a drop in the ocean compared to what's required to bring balance back to the market. So I would anticipate we're going to see some continued upward pressure and some strong growth throughout this year and into next year.
Okay, and I guess we should look at the Perth rental market, because I remember last year we were talking about, just in terms of the way the rental market is going around the country, and you were, I think you were doing a trek, you were in the bush somewhere, and you noticed some young women, and you thought and you made some commentary at the time that maybe they were not just sort of camping out for the night, but it was permanent accommodation. So what's happening with the rental market at the moment?
Good memory, first of all. We were out camping with the family, and I saw more than one single female who seemed to be, I'm not sure whether they were camping or whether they were just living there, which is quite unfortunate. And back then, which is around that time last year, our vacancy rate was 0.7%. And as of today, it sits at 0.7%. And as you know, a balanced market here is about 3 to 3.5%. So we're chronically undersupplied on that side as well. And any new housing stock that has been coming to market's been quickly soaked up by our nation-leading population growth. So it's creating a difficult situation for anyone who's seeking a rental property, which is really unfortunate for the vulnerable population. But the silver lining here for investors is if you're already in the market or if you're looking to buy soon, you're getting nation-leading growth as well as historically high yields on your investment, which is a bit of a unicorn scenario.
Yeah, and just quickly, in terms of those investors coming out of Sydney, what's been happening since the new year?
Our inquiry rates are still through the roof. It is still, there's more locals than what we had last year. So they seem to be coming out of the woodwork, but we're probably still at about 60, 70% of what we're doing in terms of acquisitions for investors specifically is coming from the East Coast, predominantly Sydney, but we're starting to see a little bit more out of Melbourne and Brisbane.
Don't navigate the real estate market alone. Let us help guide you in the world of real estate every day. Make better informed decisions with the latest news and insights.
And they know what they want to buy and what they don't want to buy as well. You don't want to be buying a dud, right? And so you need a local specialist who really understands all of that and has all those relationships with local agents. But you also need somebody who's had real experience. Now, a lot of the websites you see for buyers agents, and you read their bios and they talk about their property experience. And what they're referring to oftentimes is how long they've owned a property for or owned a number of properties for, if they're bragging about how many investments they have. That's not the sort of experience I'm talking about. I'm talking about professional experience in the real estate industry. And so really what I'd be looking for if I was looking for a buyer's agent, and I would if I was looking at buying in an area that I'm not a local specialist in, I want somebody who's got at least 10 years experience. And if they don't, then the principal in the agency that they're working has at least 10 years experience. Because over 10 years, you get to see cycles going up and going down, the worst of the markets, the best of the markets. And they really do get those insights into what makes a good asset and what should you should push yourself for versus what you shouldn't push yourself for. So that's local experience, at least 10 years experience. And then the third thing, a buyer's agent needs to have a really rigorous and thorough due diligence process. And if they can't explain how that works in their total buying process and show you and demonstrate to you the rigor that they apply to assessing a property they're recommending to you, then I would run a mile.
Yeah, it's a really good point in terms of what you said earlier, and that is, you know, somebody talking about their property portfolio, they may have bought a property at the age of 18, 19, 20. They started off early. They've got 5, 10, 15 properties. So if you take that first part about experience and portfolios, and then you merge that into some very clever marketing, and suddenly you can see why people are seduced by this person knows what they're talking about. They've got a hell of a lot of experience. I'm going to go with them.
Yeah. And the problem is that a lot of these people who have amassed, you know, high numbers of property quantity over quality is that they very rarely demonstrate benchmarking. They don't actually even know how to benchmark property performance. And they often use the wrong metrics. And yield, for example, the rental income is the wrong metric. Property is a capital growth asset. It needs to be a long-term asset. There's other ways to get income from investing without the risk that property represents, and that is where you go to a financial planner and get more holistic advice. So a lot of people are chasing the wrong things when it comes to property, and they're using the wrong metrics, and they don't actually know how to properly measure performance of a property portfolio. And so they look at the metric of volume of properties as owned as being a marker of success, whereas it could actually be hiding the truth, and that is that they don't have very good assets that haven't been growing in value. So there's a lot of, I guess, myths around that. And, you know, I was just talking actually earlier today, I was having a momentum session with my buyer's agent mentoring clients, and we were talking about the pitch of an experienced buyer's agent versus a newbie who is coming out with all these silver bullets, all these quick ways to quickly get, you know, lots of properties, and what feels like to a lot of people who don't know better, that is the pathway to property success and to wealth. It's not. And so if they don't know how to select really good assets that perform really well, they're going to fail, and it will take them years to work it out, and then there's opportunity cost. So we're not in the business of selling silver bullets, but a lot of buyer's agents, unfortunately, are out there selling silver bullets.
Yeah, and it kind of leads us in beautifully to talk about whether or not you should engage your reading skills to a higher level and read through a contract of sale before purchasing real estate in Australia, because many people just fail to do the basics.
Well, and this is the thing, and I mentioned when we met, you know, previously that the legislation, property legislation, is different in every state and territory in this country. So the contract of sale in New South Wales, for example, is vastly different to a contract of sale in Queensland. And so everybody buying in whatever jurisdiction you are buying in has to understand the what's called vendor disclosure. So that is what a vendor has to provide to you, or the information they need to provide to you to comply with legislation. And so the agent, the selling agent, obviously would hand that information to you as a prospective buyer. You've got to understand what that is, but you've also got to understand what is not disclosed, what they don't have to disclose. Because buying a property in Australia is governed by this principle called caveat emptor, which is buyer beware. And that means the responsibility is on you, the buyer, to do your due diligence and to read the contract and engage a conveyancer or solicitor to advise you on that contract before you enter into it. Too many people go and buy a property and then take the contract to the conveyancer or solicitor and say, well, I've just gone and bought this. Can you sort it all out, you know? And it's appalling because it's like you've got no idea. I mean, look, I can pick contracts apart. I'm not a lawyer, but I do know what to look for in a property contract, and I understand where the red flags are and the things to discuss with the lawyer. But I would never make an offer on a property without having the lawyer or conveyancer run through that contract and advise on it. Now, in some places, you can make conditional offers. So you need to be able to make sure that those conditions that you put forward are written properly so that they properly cover you and protect you. And so people are very cavalier about this, and they're not reading this material, and they're not understanding what the material tells them, and they're not understanding what's missing from it and where they need to get advice and when they need to get advice.
And the really big takeaway, of course, is never, ever try and do due diligence after you have signed a contract. You are trying to reverse engineer the whole process.
Oh, and it's so mortifying to hear the amount of times when it happens, and I just want to pull my hair out thinking, what on earth were you thinking? But yeah, doing the due diligence after you've signed the contract, after you've entered into a contract that you cannot get out of, right? You do the due diligence then. All you're doing is hoping that you didn't miss something.
We connect you to the best real estate information across Australia, The Real Estate Podcast.